This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I'll begin by talking about the figure in the calligraphy over the altar, who I think you'll agree there's a certain family resemblance in his demeanor and physique to our friend Mark. Figure goes by a lot of different names, Putai or Hotai. And he originally is supposed to have been based on an actual Chinese Zen hermit monk who wandered the countryside, always carrying a big sack of goodies to give out to little children who followed him around. And there's one story associated with him where someone comes up to him and asks him, "What is the meaning of Zen?" And he put down his bag. And then they asked him, "How do you practice?" And he picked up the bag and walked on. So that's our Putai koan. But the inscription up there says something like, "A mind like tofu, in a round bowl it's round, in a square bowl it's square." And I thought that was a very appropriate saying. In regards to our theme of effort, because clearly the tofu does not expend any effort in making itself round or square. It just naturally accommodates its surroundings. And as I said yesterday, you know, traditionally we would have a calligraphy of Bodhidharma over the altar, not Hotai. Bodhidharma being a kind of fierce teacher who's supposed to be our inspiration to practice. The kind of demanding patriarch for whom you have to cut your arm off to get his attention and approval. What's interesting about the way Bodhidharma is portrayed is that it's as if everyone realizes that the stories around him are so fierce and uncompromising that they can't help but to caricature him. And he's almost always portrayed in a kind of exaggerated, humorous portrait of, where his scowling features are really made the object of fun, not that aren't frightening at all. So it's as if there's this tension or dialectic within the tradition that both esteems that kind of absolute fierceness, and at the same time recognizes that it needs to turn over into its opposite, something humorous. And so Hotai, in some ways, is the mirror image of Bodhidharma, the side of practice that emerges out of fierceness and into joy. Now, the whole dilemma for us, the students, is whether we have to pass through, you know, the fire and anvil of fierceness before we're allowed to emerge into joy. Right? And there's a strong tendency in Zen to think that only by submitting to the most austere and ascetic hardships and discipline can we ever hope to attain real joy. See, I think the danger is that, as in the story of Bodhidharma and Second Patriarch, we get an image of self-hate channeled as spirituality, that the cutting off of the arm is a kind of complicated image of the way in which we come to practice with a kind of deep self-hate of our own self, our own mind and our own body. That there's some way in which we conceive of practice as a war against the self, and that there's all this language of, you know, of killing the ego, killing the self. And Second Patriarch kind of embodies this turning of the psychological self-hate we feel that brings us to practice into a spiritual practice where we kill the ego and somehow emerge from that. At best, it channels our own aggression into the service of this discipline. But at its worst, it colludes with a picture that we have, that we have to in some way destroy ourselves, destroy something basic to ourselves in order to reemerge phoenix-like in a new guise. There's a lot of imagery like that in this practice. See, Hotai represents a kind of different sensibility or image in which the mind of tofu is naturally pliant. It doesn't have to be pounded or beaten into being soft and pliant. It's naturally that way. And if anything, we could say that part of our problem with ourselves is that we are so inescapably dependent on the container we find ourselves in. In one sense, you know, the verse suggests we should become like that, have a mind that is a mind of no separation, immediately takes the form and shape of things around it. Yet in a sense, I would say that that's what we're afraid of. Because it means that we're completely dependent and vulnerable to our surroundings. And that we have to acknowledge the extent to which we are truly dependent and interdependent on everything around us. And it's, we don't want to be that soft and that pliant. I think part of us feels like that's a very dangerously vulnerable state to be in. And in fact, we'd much rather be hard and tough and disciplined, all those things that we'll associate with Bodhidharma and Ekka. It's a challenge to acknowledge and own that we are not the macho warriors of Buddhism, but that we're the little square of wiggly tofu of Zen, right? It's a very different self-image. Lots of ways we could play with that image of the tofu and the bowl. I mean, one slightly digression, but I can't help myself. Really, there is no such thing as tofu without a bowl, right? It's not like we are... See, if we think of kind of in terms of relationally or in terms of dynamic systems, there is no essential tofu nature that we have that is then shaped by our surroundings. We and our surroundings are inseparable from the get-go, and that it's part of our dilemma that we don't have a kind of essential nature that we can separate from circumstance. One version of that is that there is no mind or soul separate from the body. Those things are one thing seen from two different perspectives. It would be very nice to imagine that one could be found separate from the other and continue, something like mind or soul could continue without body. That's one of the things that essentialism or dualism offers us, why it's so tempting. But in fact, we are inseparable from our container. Right? There's no us inside something else. It's a single package. And so that we, what we are is completely, completely down to the bottom, subject to the vicissitudes of whatever befalls this mortal container of ours. Now, one thing that I like about the image of practice in the mind of tofu, again, is that it's, in a certain sense, it's completely passive. Right? It's the opposite of effort. And I've often struggled to find images like that to describe our practice that are not about effort, but about some sense of immersion. What we're doing here when we show up keeping with the image of tofu, I could say one thing that we do in Zen is marinate ourselves in silence. Right? that we come here and we just sort of steep ourselves in a certain atmosphere. Gives us a certain flavor, maybe softens us up. But however you think about it, it's not about our doing something. It's not about our struggling to make something happen. It's about allowing ourselves to simply be present and let something happen to us. I think it can make a very big difference to your sitting and to your feeling of practice if you have the sense that we're just trying to let something happen to us. We're not sort of straining and focusing and pushing to make something happen. We're just present. We're trying to quietly absorb something. I know in another sesshin I said sesshin is like taking the first step on an escalator. All you have to do is show up, take the first step, and it starts carrying you along. Right? It carries you. You're not doing the heavy lifting. You're just along for this ride, right? And you're not steering it, you're not driving it. You didn't create it. You're just letting it take you somewhere. Right? Again, to the extent that what brings us here is the way that we're all in the grip of self-centered fantasies of control and fixing and self-improvement and self-judgment, we could say that the real alternative to that is not yet another project where we're going to expend great effort, but practice being in completely the opposite mode. Instead of being in control, allowing ourselves to really just be passive, to be absorptive, right? To let something in, not to make something happen. Right? Turn all those metaphors of control around. We allow ourselves to surrender, to be controlled by sesshin, to be carried along by it. The other kind of metaphor I've come up with for this practice is looking in a mirror. When you look in a mirror, your face automatically appears. You don't have to do any work at all. Mirror is doing it. You can't do it right or wrong. Right? It's another kind of attempt to get us out of the language of technique. Right? A technique, a method, is something you can do well or badly, right or wrong. What we try to say is Zazen is the one thing you can't do right or wrong. Right? It's off that grid. That's why Dogen says, the Zazen of which I speak is not a technique of meditation. It's the Dharma gate of joy and ease. It's not a technique. It's almost impossible for us to take that in. What does it mean to do something where it just doesn't compute that you're doing it well or badly? Right? But looking at a mirror is like that. Well or badly just doesn't apply, right? Just before Mark passed away, he and I had the chance to collaborate on writing an essay for a book that will come out in the fall that I co-edited with Bob Rosenbaum. It's called What's Wrong with Mindfulness? And what isn't? He wanted to put the what and what isn't it. But Mark and I's chapter is called The Three Shaky Pillars of Buddhism. And we were sort of punning on Kaplow's old Three Pillars of Zen. And the three shaky pillars of modern contemporary Buddhism, I said, were deracination, secularization, and instrumentalization. And in particular, what mindfulness did in an extreme way, but what a lot of what's happening to Buddhism in America, deracination means being cut off from its roots, so that the people who originally came back with mindfulness, they brought it back as a technique. They cut it off from its Buddhist, Southeast Asia cultural roots and tried to turn it into specifically a kind of secularized technique of meditation, which could then be instrumentalized and even medicalized, right? And what that did was something very valuable and very powerful, but it took it out of the realm of religion and put it into the realm of technique. Right? It became something that you do as a means to an end, whether in terms of relaxation technique or stress reduction or working with trauma, however it's expanded or marketed, it explicitly became a means to an end, and one that could be validated by testing and validated by science. Right? It's part of the mindset that we saw displayed in some of the Garrison tape on the first night here. Bringing together, you know, meditation and science and sharing the fruits of those techniques, right? Now, obviously, all of that has great value, but it's a very specific, focused kind of value. And what Mark and I tried to write about is what is lost or what's transformed when meditation stops being a religious practice and becomes a technique. See, then it specifically becomes something that you do well or badly, that has results or doesn't have results, right? What's the opposite of that? It's what we always say about Zazen, that it's useless, right? We lose the uselessness, right? We lose the fact that the very nature of this is to get us off means-to-end thinking, right? Where each thing, instead of being an end in itself, is always on the way somewhere else, right? Now, it's so deeply ingrained in our thinking that you know, we can't help but, you know, think about Zen as a technique to attain enlightenment. Even in the midst of a religious practice, that way of thinking about things is basic. It's very hard to isolate that and deconstruct it and even begin to imagine the alternative. But the alternative I'm trying to point to is something that is not about effort and it's not about results. It's about what happens when self-improvement comes to an end, right? When the whole internal project of judgment and fixing and controlling stops, right? And we step back from that. And in a certain sense, a sesshin is is a laboratory to bring that about. And if you want, you can say that's, you know, you see, you've got an end in mind that we're trying to do that, right? Okay. But what we're trying really is to deconstruct our basic compulsive project of self-improvement, right? And to really find a way to leave ourselves alone. And it's so ingrained in us that we have to take some pretty extreme measures to counteract it. Yeah. But the it really is possible that the atmosphere of our sesshin can be as much in the spirit of Putai as in Bodhidharma. You know, as Michael Wenger from San Francisco once said, everybody always talks about practicing harder. Maybe we need to learn to practice softer. Right? This is an attempt to think about what does it mean to practice softer. It's in that spirit that we modified our meal chants here, where we talk now about for to enjoy our life, we take this food. And thus we enjoy this food with everyone, right? Somehow enjoyment had gotten banished from practice, and in so many of these chants, meals were treated medicinally. You know, well, we're just grudgingly taking this meal, so we'll stay alive and practice a little longer, right? Doesn't feel that way. We want to eat lunch. We like it, you know. And there's nothing wrong with that. We will not overcome suffering by renouncing pleasure. Right? That's a very basic idea that somehow we gets messed up in this practice sometimes, as if pleasure and attachment and clinging and desire are all these things we're supposed to get rid of, right? And it turns into a, you know, if you this very ascetic sense of in order not to suffer, you have to not hold on, care about, desire, be attached to anything. It's a mentality of if you've got nothing, you've got nothing to lose, right? Well, that's no way to live. Right? It's not what we're doing here. What we practice with is the fact that we love our life. Hopefully we love one another. We love our life moment to moment in every aspect. And at the same time, we realize how vulnerable we are and our life is. How we are really just little quivering blobs of tofu, you know, that anything can puncture or hurt or damage. That everything we love and hold on to is going to go away. That's the reality. But the solution is to is not to stop loving it, not to stop being attached or connected. It's to enjoy it as long and as much as we can. Let's practice in a way that we appreciate our life together.